Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The four remaining Republican GOP presidential candidates are brushing up on their Spanish as they prepare for another televised debate in Florida tonight. Polls show the frontrunners, Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney, locked in a dead heat, both courting Florida's influential Cuban-American population. Romney says he wants Castro off the planet. Gingrich has pledged to use every non-military tool to end Castro's regime. And Castro? Well, the 85-year-old Cuban dictator released a statement saying this year's Republican field is the greatest competition of idiocy and ignorance the world has ever seen. Miami Herald's political reporter Mark Caputo joins us on the line. And Mark, Castro weighing in there. And you have a pretty interesting fact in your piece that Miami-Dade's Cuban exile population accounts for just under three-quarters of the Republican vote in this largest county in the country's largest swing state. That's a lot.
Yeah, 72% of the registered Republicans in Miami-Dade are Hispanic. About 99% of them, and that's an estimate both from me and pollsters, are Cuban.
Well,
it's big.
And polls show that Gingrich is losing badly to Romney among these Cuban-American voters in Florida, and that might explain some of the attack ads he's put out. Yesterday, the Gingrich campaign was forced to withdraw one, though, because it labeled Romney anti-immigrant, and Florida Senator Marco Rubio objected to that. Let's just listen to a little of it in Spanish.
Él es el candidato más anti-inmigrante. Mitt Romney tendrá la fama, pero no tiene la sustancia para ser nuestro presidente.
Mitt Romney doesn't have the stuff to be president. And so Marco Rubio, who's being talked about as a potential vice president, told Gingrich take it off, and he did.
Yeah, well, you didn't quite tell him to take it off. He may as well have told him. Rubio kind of lowered the boom for Gingrich there. The problem that Rubio and other Republicans have is that they have a more conservative line on immigration, which Romney shares, and which Gingrich in large part shares. But when Gingrich comes out of the box and starts calling Romney anti-immigrant, he's technically calling most of his fellow Republicans that, and playing off of the conservative reservation.
Yeah, and what Marco Rubio did say is the truth is that neither of these men is anti-immigrant. Both are pro-legal immigration, and so there you have that. But former Florida Governor Jeb Bush also wrote an opinion piece in today's Washington Post advising the Republicans to sort of adjust their thinking on how they address the issue of immigration. He said, think of it as an economics issue, not just a border security issue. You know, where is Jeb Bush in all of this?
Well, Jeb is kind of making himself heard. Had he run in this election year, some of his initiatives as governor probably would have come back to haunt him. He had supported allowing undocumented or illegal immigrants to actually have driver's licenses. That's kind of anathema to those segments of the conservative movement, which think that that's sort of a magnet that you would provide to illegal immigrants. But he's always urged all along. He met his wife in Mexico. She's Mexican. He's urged all along to have a more careful, intelligent tone about the immigration debate, because one of the problems that you can have is a lot of these guys start talking about immigration and controlling the borders, and things can start to spin out of control, and there are those elements, probably extreme elements in the conservative movement, Republican Party, which can start to sound anti-Hispanic, and that's how you lose the Hispanic vote when people start thinking, it's not that you don't want illegal immigrants around. It's that you don't want people around who have vowels and Z's at the end of their name.
It's a perception. Well, then explain this, though, because as we said, Romney beats Gingrich in the polls when it comes to these Cuban-American voters, and he's had some pretty unpopular positions among Hispanics. He said he'd veto legislation that would give legal status to some young illegal immigrants who attend college. He opposes the DREAM Act, which provides these educational benefits to illegal immigrants. Gingrich, as the only Republican candidate who supports giving legal status to illegal immigrants who've lived in the U.S. for years. And he derides Mitt Romney for Mitt Romney's comments that, Hispanics might self-deport, if some of their if they were cut off from certain things like, some benefits. So what's the disconnect? Why isn't Gingrich making more traction with these Cuban Americans? Is it because, as exiles, they are maybe more conservative?
Well, that's part of it. Understand that Florida's Hispanic population or Latino population is different from the rest of the nation's. Our largest population here is Cuban American. Cubans have a special status in U.S. immigration law. They're essentially guaranteed a path to citizenship, that is, asylum, if they land in the United States. There are essentially no other groups that have that, but for a few exceptions here and there. So that's one thing. The other large immigrant group, or Hispanic group, I should say, in Florida are Puerto Ricans. They're U.S. citizens. So all of this hand-wringing, the concern over helping illegal immigrants or helping more immigrants get into this country is not shared by the major blocks of Hispanic voters, the two major blocks of Hispanic voters in Florida. So the immigration debate affects Florida's Hispanics on the whole differently.
Yeah. Well,
as for Gingrich mocking this idea of self-deportation, you know, a few months ago, his own spokesman described his plan as kind of revolving around self-deportation. And in 2010, in a Laura Ingraham radio show interview, she talked about self-deportation. He said he agreed with her. So his position is changing somewhat.
Well, this idea that there's two different kind of votes, and the minute we have Mark Caputo, take that wider, because Politico has an analysis of the Florida race as the Tea Party versus the Cocktail Party. Angry, less well-off, anti-Washington, conservative Floridians versus wealthy retirees. Just, do you feel that?
I think there are many elements of that are very true. So I think in great part. The other thing, though, there's a broader story, is that there's a lot of conservatives don't like Mitt Romney. This has been a theme all along, and we're seeing it again. So a lot of the folks who do like Mitt Romney do happen to be kind of these more establishment-type figures, so de facto it can start to look like establishment versus non-establishment. But certainly there are those elements of the Conservative Party that don't like Mitt Romney's positions on social issues as they've changed, gay marriage, abortion, et cetera, and even on immigration.
Well, as we constantly find out, Mark Caputo, these hard lines that we like to draw because they make for neat headlines do not always work. Mark Caputo, a politics reporter for the Miami Herald, ahead of tonight's debate in Florida and then, of course, next week's primary. Mark, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Do you remember this moment in Tuesday's State of the Union?
Our ironclad commitment, and I mean ironclad, to Israel's security has meant the closest military cooperation between our two countries in history.
But an article in Foreign Policy raises questions about the U.S.-Israel relationship when it comes to intelligence gathering and Iran. The article says officers from Israel's spy agency Mossad posed as American CIA agents who then recruited members of the terrorist group Jundallah to fight in Israel's covert war against Iran. In the intelligence business, this is called a false flag operation. It happened during the last years of the George W. Bush administration, and it apparently affected cooperation between the U.S. and Israel when President Obama assumed office. Author and historian Mark Perry wrote the piece for Foreign Policy. Mark, this is fascinating. Your thoughts, though, when you heard that comment from President Obama, was it your sense that while that rosy look at the relationship might now be true, it wasn't true for a while?
It was an interesting comment. I wasn't really surprised. I think that in any strong alliance, and certainly this was, I'm a historian, so I know it was true in World War II, where there were real deep divisions and arguments between the British and American senior commanders, that in any alliance there are real bumps in the road. And it's clear that we have those kinds of bumps in the road with Israel. And we've had them in the near past, and certainly we continue to have them. But I think that, you know, we get past those bumps in the road, and we have a clear, strong strategic alliance, and that was reflected in President Obama's statement.
Okay, well, let's tell how you came to your writing in Foreign Policy. You write about memos that have been read by others, people who are intimately familiar with this, and it sort of jumps off stories accusing the CIA of covertly supporting this group, Jundallah. Of course, you know, what's revealed is it wasn't the CIA supporting Jundallah. It was Israelis masquerading as CIA agents. But first of all, tell us, who or what is Jundallah?
Jundallah is a separatist group inside Iran that wants to separate Balochistan, which is in southeastern Iran, from the rest of the country. It's a Sunni-dominated region of Iran, and Iran is a Shia state. And this separatist organization has been operating actually for quite some time, for 10 to 15 years, a very violent very anti-Tehran. Its operations are very reminiscent of what al-Qaeda does, beheadings, suicide bombings, assassinations, and it's on the foreign terrorist organization list. Now, when the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, recruited them, it wasn't on the foreign terrorist operations list, but this is a group with a distinct odor that the United States really didn't want to have anything to do with. So the fact that Mossad was recruiting them as posing as CIA officers was a real problem for us.
And why would the Israeli agents bother posing as CIA agents to recruit members of Jandala to continue their violent acts against Iran? Why would they, you know, have to do that?
Well, it seems to me there are two or three reasons. First, it's more likely for a group like Jandala to talk to Americans than Israelis. This is a real sensitivity in the Middle East, and no group wants to be accused of being, as the phrase would be, pro-Zionist. The second reason is, I don't think there's any doubt among policymakers here that Israel feels under threat from Iran and wants American protection, and this would pull the United States into the Israeli agenda. And I think that a third reason here is that these kinds of operations are not that difficult to do. It's happened before. Israeli agents have posed as Americans. While I don't think that this is a usual operation, it's not unheard of.
Well, and it led to accusations that it was CIA agents that were backing this group and backing these horrific violent acts. And, you know, U.S. administrations have been adamant. They're not happy with Iran, but they're also not going to sponsor these acts. So this goes on for several years. The Israelis are recruiting these Jandala members. And it's discovered at the end of the George W. Bush administration. Do we know how the Bush administration reacted when they found out? How did George Bush react when he found out?
The information that I have is that, as an intelligence officer told me, Bush went absolutely ballistic. He thought that Israel had crossed the red line. This was not something that intelligence agencies are supposed to do. It involved us in Israel's covert war. And I think most importantly, it subverted the principle that we've stated again and again and again, that we don't work with terrorists, we don't cooperate with terrorists, we're opposed to terrorism and the war on terrorism, we target terrorists, we don't use them for our own purposes. This was a real strike, let's say, at our own principles, and it painted us as hypocrites in the Middle East, which is something that this administration, the Obama administration, and the Bush administration were very sensitive about.
In fact, you quote an intelligence officer who said, "It's amazing what the Israelis thought they could get away with. Their recruitment activities of Jandala were nearly in the open. They apparently didn't give a damn what we thought." That's historian Mark Perry. We're talking to him about his article in Foreign Policy that details how agents from Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, posed as American CIA agents to recruit members of a terrorist group who would then go fight against Iran during President Bush's administration. Fascinating. When we come back, what about recent assassinations in Iran? Who's behind that? Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Mark Perry about his fascinating story in Foreign Policy that tells of an Israeli intelligence operation in which agents from the Israeli spy agency Mossad posed as CIA officers to recruit members of the Sunni extremist group Jandala to fight against Iran. I know it's complicated, so I keep repeating it. Mark talked to people who'd read CIA memos written during the last years of the President George W. Bush administration. These memos said Israel's recruiting activities were blatant, sometimes taking place in London, where Mossad agents passing themselves off as CIA officers met with Jandala officials. An intelligence officer who spoke with Mark about this so-called false flag operation said President Bush went ballistic when he found out about it, and that Israel's relationship with Jandala continued to roil the president until he left office. But Mark Perry, what happened when President Obama came in? How did that rift with Israel get healed, or has it been?
I think that it has been. The CIA and the intelligence services of the United States in general do cooperate with the Israelis on intelligence gathering operations. But we tend to keep our distance when it comes to covert operations. And as a former CIA officer told me, we do not do bang and boom, and we do not do assassinations. Our relationship with the Mossad now, particularly when it comes to Iran, is strictly information gathering. And while the Israelis may want us to go beyond that, it's clear from the discussions and interviews I've had with intelligence officials that we just won't. We won't go beyond that. That we are very sensitive when it comes to talk about conducting assassinations. It's something we don't do.
By the way, do we know how members of Jindala reacted when they found out that it wasn't American agents that recruited them, but it was Israelis?
We have a pretty good idea. The head of Jindala, Abdelmalek Rizvi, was disappointed. He had some suspicions that, in fact, these weren't CIA officers, that they were Israelis. There was a meeting in Casablanca where Israeli officers said that they were members of a NATO covert operations intelligence operation. NATO doesn't have such an operation. I think that they felt used and abused, and frankly, the capture of the head of Jindala was the result of a Pakistan intelligence operation with the winking approval of the United States to turn this man over to the Iranians. We really wanted nothing to do with Jindala or organizations like it.
Well, as you said, the head of Jindala was captured. The covert operation has been blown. Certainly no one right now is getting recruited by an Israeli posing as a CIA agent. But are we seeing the end result of that earlier recruiting? We know 4 Iranian scientists have been assassinated in the last 2 years, one just earlier this month, someone on a motorcycle attached a magnetic explosive device to this scientist's car. Do we know if that's the work of Jindala?
We don't know. We don't know who did this. But we have a fairly good idea. This is a very sophisticated operation. Putting a magnetic bomb in a car might seem like a simple task, but it has all the hallmarks of a foreign intelligence agent's and their recruiting techniques and their technical expertise to do it. Our Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, said that he thought he knew who did it, and the clear implication from his statement, at least as I understood it, was that Israel was behind it. We've had the assassination of 4 Iranian scientists, very high-profile assassinations. Listen, I think it's very clear Israel feels threatened by Iran, mm-hmm. and when a country feels threatened by another, it will take whatever steps are necessary to defend itself, and in the case of Israel, they feel their very existence is threatened. So we shouldn't be surprised that Israel would do it. I think that the real sensitivity here is that they did it while posing as CIA officers. No one denies Israel's right to defend itself. The question is, should you involve your ally when you do that?
And I guess my question is, do we know if it was Israeli officers or if it was these Israeli-recruited Jindala members? I guess we just don't know.
We don't know. Like I say, it appears that it's the work of a foreign intelligence agency of real sophistication. Certainly Israel has the capability and the means, motive, and opportunity to do it. But we don't know whether this was a Jindala operation supported by Israel.
No.
And frankly, Iran has a long line of enemies. It could have been anybody. It could have been an internal group, but we just don't know.
You also mentioned in your story a terrorist group that we weren't familiar with, Mujahideen-e-Khalq?
Mujahideen-e-Khalq, the MAK.
Who are they?
They're bigger than Jindala, more deeply rooted, anti-Iranian, very violent. And what's really disturbing, they're on the Foreign Terrorist Organization list, but American officials or former serving American officials have been seen talking at their conferences and supporting them, I think, in clear violation of the law. If we think Jindala is bad, we ought to get a load of the MEK. They're really a violent organization.
What are you saying? The thinking, an enemy and of my enemy is my
is
friend.
Is my friend,
should,
yeah.
But should we not be thinking that? I mean, in other words, is this playing with fire?
We should not be thinking it. The enemy of my enemy is not always my friend. And we are playing with fire if we're dealing with the MEK. My information is we're not at all officially dealing with the MEK. It's very disturbing that very prominent former senior officials of the current Obama and the Bush administration seem to be supporting in this group and wanting to take them off the foreign terrorist organization list. They're very violent, and they're a terrorist organization.
And they could as easily turn on the U.S. as on Iran, it sounds like you're saying.
Yeah, and they have. They have killed Americans in the past, and they're described to me by intelligence officers as less of a movement and more of a cult. I think that's accurate.
Mark Perry, his article about these CIA memos that show that Mossad, the Israeli spy agency, posed as CIA operatives to recruit members of the terrorist group Jandala to fight in Iran, appears in Foreign Policy magazine. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. By the way, Mark's upcoming book due out this year, MacArthur at War. Looking forward to that. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
So what are your thoughts? Do you think this is the same old spy versus spy? Which, by the way, was a question on Jeopardy last night. Mad Magazine was the answer. But let us know your thoughts, hereandnow.org. When we come back, the latest news, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and by Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and by the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston, with Isaac Julian's 10,000 Waves, a 9-screen video installation featuring Maggie Chung, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Indiana, in the heart of the industrial Midwest and where about 10% of the workforce is unionized, is now the country's 23rd state to vote to ban contracts that require workers to pay mandatory union fees in order to get representation. The law, which Republicans across the country have labeled the Right to Work Law, passed last night by the Indiana House of Representatives and is expected to be signed by Governor Mitch Daniels. It's a blow to unions who fear it could spread to other Rust Belt states. Micheline Maynard is senior editor of the public radio project Changing Gears, and she blogs about the auto industry for Forbes.com. So, Mickey, help us here, because last year both Wisconsin and Ohio passed laws stripping most public sector unions of collective bargaining rights. This Indiana law addresses the private sector, but how else are they different, and how big a deal do you think the Indiana law is?
Well, first of all, to take your second question first, I think this is a huge deal. The labor movement is petrified of right-to-work laws. The last right-to-work law that we saw was in Oklahoma in 2001, but most of them before that go back for 20 or 30 years. We've never seen one in the industrial Great Lakes. So I think this is an even bigger deal than what happened with public employee bargaining rights, simply because private sector unions are the unions that made the labor movement famous.
Well, and so what does it mean exactly, this idea that the new law, you know, it has been named Right to Work, which of course is controversial right there, but the new law, we understand, will ban contracts that require workers to pay mandatory union fees. Explain more. What does that mean workers in these private companies can do?
Well, essentially, if a union is formed in your workplace, the union can charge you dues because it is negotiating a contract that will cover you. You basically have two options. You can join the union and pay dues, or you can just pay the dues, in which case you don't get a vote. I was actually in that situation at the University of Michigan because it has an organization representing its lecturers, and I faced the decision, do I want to join the union or do I want to just pay the money? And I thought, I might as well have a vote, so I joined the union.
And so the new law says what? You don't have to pay the fees, but you can still get represented by the union?
Well, no, you would not. You don't have to join the union, and you don't have to pay the dues. So what this means is, mm-hmm. you know, a union forms in a Kmart, and Kmart employees have the option of joining the union or not joining the union. And if you have a right to work law, they don't have to join and they don't have to pay the dues.
But I guess what's missing for me is, this is probably just me, but do they then get the benefit of whatever contracts are brought by the union?
Yes.
Okay.
And see, that's the main situation here, is that unions have always argued, join up with us, we will represent the group, we will get benefits for the group. So in this case, you can try to form a union in the organization, and you could try to negotiate a contract with management, but your workforce does not have to pay you, and your workforce does not have to join your organization.
And so, of course, a union that has its funds depleted because they're not taking in fees becomes a very not as strong a union.
Well, that's a very very good point, because I think one of the reasons why the Teamsters and the FL-CIO and the UAW over the years became so powerful was not just the sheer number of people that belonged to them, but also the dues that they paid and the political action contributions that they make. You know, there's power in numbers of people, but there's also power in money as well.
Well, in Wisconsin and Ohio, we only got about a minute here, voters, you know, fought back against those, again, public sector laws. There's a recall movement going on right now in Wisconsin. But what do you see happening from the Indiana vote? Democrats there who are against this law just did not have the votes in the Republican majority legislature there. Do you see it spreading to other states like Michigan?
Yes, I do think that the right-to-work proponents in Michigan will use Indiana as fuel for their fire, essentially. Governor Snyder, who is a Republican, has said repeatedly it is not a priority with him, but if his Republican legislature passes a right-to-work law, it will be on his desk and he will have a very important decision to make.
Well, and we will keep on it with you. Micheline Maynard, senior editor of the public radio project Changing Gears, and she also blogs about the auto industry for Fords.com. We'll link you up at hereandnow.org. Mickey, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, coming up, Bloomberg columnist Jonathan Alter wants to bust what he says are myths about President Obama. That's in 30 seconds, here and now. President Obama's approval rating averaged about 44% during his third year in office, the lowest of any president since Eisenhower, but comparable to Presidents Nixon and Reagan, who ran strong re-election bids. President Obama is facing critics from the left who accuse him of siding with Wall Street, from the right who call him a socialist. Jonathan Alter, columnist for Bloomberg View, says at least some of the criticism is myth. His recent opinion piece in The Washington Post is headlined Five Myths About Barack Obama. And Jonathan, start with the claim that President Obama is a socialist. You trace that back to something then-candidate Obama said to Joe the Plumber on the campaign trail about money?
He said he wanted to, you know, spread it around, and that was seized on by the McCain campaign as evidence that Barack Obama was a socialist. There was never any merit to it. If one believed that he was a socialist because of the TARP bailout, then you would have to say the same of George W. Bush and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and a lot of other capitalists.
We remember the image of then-Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson on bended knee in the Oval Office begging Nancy Pelosi in this emergency meeting with President Bush to allow this bailout of Wall Street.
I have that scene in a book I wrote about Obama's first year as president. Seconds later, Barney Frank comes running across the room cursing loudly, waving his arms. Barack Obama had to break up a near fist fight between Barney Frank and Hank Paulson.
So the bailout started under George W. Bush, but what about other claims? I mean, Jonah Goldberg, writing in Commentary in 2010, says that President Obama wanted to nationalize car companies, stage a partial government takeover of health care.
This is just disinformation, Robin. I mean, take the banks. There were a number of liberals who were very disappointed that the president didn't nationalize the banks. He didn't. He chose to leave banking in private hands. It was not a government takeover of healthcare. That's just a lie. The healthcare reform keeps the healthcare system in private hands. And of course, the car companies, the president didn't try to operate those car companies. He simply insisted that they be restructured in exchange for being bailed out and saved. And it's been a tremendous success.
Well, and back to the healthcare reform, you point out, as others have, the individual mandate aspect of it came from the Conservative Heritage Foundation. And the whole plan is, of course, modeled on former Governor Mitt Romney's Massachusetts reform.
And on Bob Dole's ideas from the 1990s. So the idea that he's a tool of Wall Street that you sometimes hear on the left is also a myth. He now is fighting for taxes on millionaires and all kinds of other things that make Wall Street upset.
Well, you say he is now, but that's after people had to take to the streets. A lot of people felt that that was a tone-deaf White House that missed an opportunity earlier on, that President Obama didn't use the leverage he had after the financial bailout to rein in Wall Street, that he had Clinton-era retreads like Timothy Geithner, Larry Summers, who had been part of deregulation, that he did nothing about the huge salaries and bonuses that came up again on Wall Street after it was bailed out. That, yes, he might have fought for a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, but he didn't keep the woman who founded it, Elizabeth Warren, primarily because she was butting heads with Tim Geithner.
There's something to what you just described, but it is considerably more complicated. First of all, he did do something about the bonuses for those companies that were under TARP supervision, which were the only ones he had any authority over. I agree with the criticism that he should have used more of his leverage over the banks when he had it, and I think history will say it was a mistake not to push for what they call cram-down authority so that courts could renegotiate people's mortgages. But they did put in Dodd-Frank, which is far from a perfect bill, but is a hell of a lot better than the lack of regulation that we had before. And if you ask Elizabeth Warren about it, as I have, you know, she's very complimentary of the president. Senate Democrats, like Chris Dodd, tried to take the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau out of the Dodd-Frank bill, and President Obama insisted that it be left in the bill. I also wish that he had named her as a recess appointment, but I think they decided it would be better for her to pick up a seat for the Democrats in the Senate, which she has a very good chance of doing.
I want to pick up a thought from Thomas Frank, author of the book Pity the Billionaire, who says that President Obama betrayed the voters who elected him, that he ran like a populist but governed like a plutocrat. And Frank goes back to a passage from Obama's book, The Audacity of Hope, when he wrote about how when you get into Washington circles, you start meeting people who are pro-choice, anti-gun, smart people, but they found unions troublesome, weren't sympathetic to people whose lives were upended by the movements of global capital. And Obama goes on to say that he became more like them. Now, he writes how you have to fight those forces, but Frank says, yes, you did become like them. You can check off certain progressive boxes, like, you know, pro-choice, but you increasingly don't care as much about people, is what Frank seems to be saying. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah. You know, I respect Thomas Frank. I just don't agree with this particular analysis. I do think that by selecting certain kinds of advisors, he put himself in sort of a cozy world of people who, if they had not themselves worked on Wall Street, they nonetheless were in that world, and he restricted too much the level of advice that he got and the array of advice that he got. But I think it's wrong that he's governing at odds with the way he campaigned. And all you have to do is look at what he promised and didn't promise in the campaign. He didn't promise to nationalize the banks. And by the way, in retrospect, the decision not to nationalize the banks was the right call. So a lot of what liberals were so sure was the right thing to do in 2009 turned out not to be required. Now, do I wish they had handled housing policy better? You bet I do. But I don't think that's because, you know, the president is some kind of a sellout to Wall Street.
You also contend that Obama's stimulus did not fail. Things could be better, but it didn't fail. And when it comes to the myth that he's a weak leader, you say people who worked for both President Bill Clinton and President Obama said that while Clinton might have been more creative, Obama was more decisive.
Anybody who pushes through health care, which is something Democrats have been trying to get done for more than 75 years, pushes it through over the objections of much of his staff, is a leader. The test is not whether you agree with it or not. Like, I didn't agree with the direction that President Bush took the country, going to war and the rest of it. But it certainly wasn't weak leadership. And that's the way Obama should be viewed, too, to say that he's somehow not a leader, as Chris Christie and others are alleging now, is at odds with the record, where he took enormous risks, killing Osama bin Laden. Obama went forward with a risky plan that could have broken his presidency, and that is leadership.
Jonathan Alter, columnist for Bloomberg View. His latest book is The Promise, President Obama Year One, and we'll link you to his Washington Post op-ed about what he thinks are the five myths about Barack Obama. Jonathan, thanks for touching in with us. And I know you're running off to something on a cell phone, so we really appreciate it.
Okay, take care.
Well, Steve Fay writes on Facebook, how about the myth that Obama's going to take all your guns away? He doesn't even have a gun control agenda. Let us know what you think. Our myths about President Obama at hereandnow.org. Here and Now. Welcome back. The Supreme Court recently rejected an electoral map drawn by a Texas judge. Florida's legislature is plotting a new map for that state. It'll include the two new congressional districts. In Chicago, Mayor Emanuel and Chicago's aldermen recently worked out a new ward map in a horse trading session behind closed doors in the dead of the night. Maps count. But when was the last time you looked at one, not online? If it's been a while, we've got a suggestion. The map that took the top prize, best of show, at last year's Cartography and Geographic Information Society competition. Past winners have included National Geographic, the CIA, the U.S. Census Bureau, big guns in the cartography world. But the newest winner? A guy named Dave Imus. He joins us now from the studios of Don Ross Productions in Eugene, Oregon. Dave, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you, Robin. It's nice to talk to you.
Well, people are making a big deal about this. You know, wow, look at this. Imus Geographics won. What's Imus Geographics? It's one guy named Dave Imus. How long did you spend making this?
Oh, you know, about as long as it takes to write a long novel. I worked on it 7 days a week, 10 or 12 hours pretty much every day for 2 years. So, you know, it was at least 5,000 hours, but I'm guessing it was more like 6,000 hours of time. I collaborate with Pat Dunleavy in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Pat puts together all this data, you know, road locations and shorelines and things like that. What it allows me to do is trace that data and analyze it as I'm going and try to render a map that somebody can read. So every time I'm drafting a road or putting a type label on it or something like that, I ask myself, if I wasn't me, would I be able to understand this? Would I be able to read it?
Well, then that's what people who are raving about your map say. Journalist Seth Stevenson writes in Slate that it's masterful and that you spend hours picking font types, letter thicknesses, levels of colors and shading, instead of making each state a different color. You spent your time on, let's say, showing how there might be denser forestation by levels of green, or how there might be yellow areas that are higher population centers.
What I did differently than anybody else who ever made a map of the United States was that I brought into focus the principal elements of the United States, the basic geography. People that read this map or look at it on the wall can understand and appreciate more deeply the character of the United States, just to understand this country, the lay of the land. This map treats the character of each state so that we can distinguish one state from another by its unique geographic character instead of by these arbitrary colors that one might assign to them.
You're one guy, so you sort of have control over this, and you make personal decisions about what you want to do.
That's a key point. Rand McNally and National Geographic, for sure, has been publishing the same U.S. map for many decades. Somebody like me comes along, and I'm this artist living out in the boonies. I've got the freedom to make any kind of map I want to. So I looked at those maps, and I noticed that we didn't have a United States map that made our geography understandable. So I endeavored to do that.
Well, and you've done that, but also I'm looking at Chicago, and you've included, oh, look, there's Wrigley Field and a little icon where Northwestern University would be and, oh, Grant Park. But I see when I compare it, let's say, to the National Geographic map, you had to give up the town of South Haven, which would have been there. No offense to anyone in South Haven, but that's kind of cool that there's Wrigley Field. So you made those choices, it seems.
You know, I did because, you know, Wrigley Field is an essential part of Chicago. It's part of what makes Chicago, Chicago. In blogs and on my Facebook page and stuff, some people took me to task for eliminating populated places in deference to landmarks like that. But if you were looking at a map of Egypt and it had a bunch of towns on it but didn't include the pyramids, wouldn't you think, hey, wouldn't the pyramids have told us something about Egypt that a bunch of place name labels doesn't tell? And so that I made this decision to show 1,000 iconic American landmarks that people have heard of, but that have just been completely overlooked on U.S. maps. I'm talking about basic things, you know, like the Statue of Liberty and the Alamo and, you know, the San Andreas Fault and the Iditarod Trail. I mean, these things we've heard of that are overlooked, but they're Americana. They're the things that make Americans who they are and tie us together as a country.
How did you get started? Why this passion for maps?
I don't know. You know, both my parents are very geographically oriented people. In fact, the best geographic editor, the best fact checker that I could find to look at my maps before they got published are my mother. So, you know, I've just had this background of geography, and my dad taught me to be a real seat-of-the-pants navigator. We used to go hiking in the mountains to lakes and things, which sometimes required map and compass to get to.
It's funny, just even talking about this has sort of stirred something in me. I remember when I was young, I sent away to, I think it was Mobil Gas or something. I wanted to take a cross-country trip, and they would send you a book with the maps of, you know, how you should drive. And when you were talking about putting the icons on your map of the Alamo, I was thinking, the Alamo. You'd love to go see the Alamo. But do you think that this is an endangered feeling? Most people are traveling sitting at home on their computer.
Well, there's two basic kinds of maps, and Americans are very familiar with maps that are aids to navigation, and that's what Google Maps are, and that's what those mobile maps were, and they are very valuable tools. Even though the Google map that I printed out to help me find this studio in a sort of remote location in Eugene, Oregon, was wrong, and I had to I had to use the written instructions that were provided to find the place. But the other kind of map, the type of map that Americans really have never had, is maps that help us understand the lay of the land, where things are relative to each other, and how all these elements of roads and rivers and cities and mountains and forests and lakes and on go together to create this fabric or tapestry.
Well, now you've got me thinking about that map in whatever it was, fourth grade, fifth grade. It was raised so you could actually put your hand on it where the mountains were and you could actually feel them. But do you worry that maps are going to become a thing of the past?
The maps that are aids to navigation, perhaps, but I don't think that maps like I've made of the United States will be a thing of the past, because they do allow us to let it really sink in, that just how big and spread out and wonderful and fascinating our country is, that you're never going to get on a computer screen until those screens perhaps match the resolution of a printed map.
Well, what happens now? You spent 2 years, 6,000 hours. Was there a cash prize that came with this award? I'm hoping. Was there?
Oh, don't I wish. You know, map makers are so low-key. The organization that held the competition, you know, they didn't even send out a press release. Could you imagine? Couldn't you imagine Hollywood having the Academy Awards and not telling anybody?
Well,
so, you know, I'm trying to change that, too, you know, try to get maps kind of out there.
Well, we'll do our little part. Dave Imus of Imus Geographics, but don't be fooled. We've just heard from Imus Geographics, all of it, who created the map, The Essential Geography of the United States. It took top prize, best of show at last year's Cartography and Geographic Information Society competition. And we'll link you to everything you need to know at hereandnow.org. Dave, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. It's been fun.